Thank you guys for all getting up so early on the final day of South by Southwest. I hope you guys are. Have you had a good show thus far? Yes, awesome. Good parties, panels, I'm hoping. Very good. All right, so welcome. Thank you guys all for coming. My name is Ben Cote. I am moderating this wonderful panel. So we got some great people up here. I want to make this panel a little more interactive than the other interactive panels, because I've kind of been disappointed in what I see, where people talk for 50 minutes and then they answer two questions and it's kind of sad. So we're probably gonna do Q&A a little earlier, and I want to get you guys more involved because I want to make sure that we're talking about what you guys want us to be talking about, and you guys get what out of this, what you guys want to get out of this. So my name, Ben Cote, again, I work for DivX and formerly Stage Six. Very sad moment of silence. So again, yeah, I have very little expertise with piracy. I've only worked there for 8 years and with Stage Six. So I'm going to rely on you guys for some help there. I'll let these guys introduce themselves, but just on the panel, we got M. Strange, the over 9,000 Uber rector. That's over 9,000 people. Dean Marks, the senior VP of IP over at Warner Brothers. Carlton Evans, associate director of the Mockte Institute, and Jason Schultz, who is filling in for Fred von Lohmann, who couldn't be here because he had to be back in LA for some depositions. So he is filling in. So sorry about that. But so I'll let them just kind of go down the line and introduce themselves real quick and kind of tell them a little about themselves.
Okay. Hello there. So yeah, my name's M. Strange. I'm an animator. I'm kind of known for like making this crazy animated feature film in my bedroom that went to like Sundance and did all this stuff. And then the reason I'm here on this piracy panel is that, so, you know, we'll throw out wild claims and state our position. So I'm very pro piracy. And my film was pirated by one of the like biggest torrent groups like in Sweden. And I coined a term called torrential. So it's like your torrent theatrical release. It's a new type of release that filmmakers can exploit, and you should be happy it happened. So I'm from the stance that like my stance is that you should be happy as an independent working in this small sphere if anybody wants to watch your movie in any way, and you figure out how to make money off it after. So that's what I do. I make films with an extremely low budget, high quality products, but I'm all for piracy. So
I'm Carlton Evans, associate director of the Mockte Institute. A couple of years ago, we produced a short film called The Tribe that went to Sundance and then played at about 80 festivals since then. It was released on iTunes in October and hit the number one spot within a couple of weeks. We've been completely self-distributing it, and we estimate that about 150,000 people have seen this film. The mandate of the Mockte Institute is to do experiments on self-distribution, and then learn from them and share our findings with other filmmakers.
My name's Dean Marks, and I work for Warner Brothers.
Hold the microphone closer.
Is this any better?
Even closer.
Do I have to swallow it?
Okay. There you go.
Hey, my name's Dean Marks, and I work for Warner Brothers. I was put on this panel to be the bullseye that everyone could throw eggs at.
He's the man in this case.
Yes, that's right. I work for the man. Anyway, I'm a copyright lawyer and do copyright for Warner Brothers. I needless to say, probably you can assume that we're not thrilled when our particular works get pirated, although we have what may be some surprising attitudes and perspectives on some of the uses of parts of our works and mashups and all the rest of it. And that's something I'll show a couple of examples of and give both a little bit of a legal analysis from the law side and then sort of what we're doing as a practical matter. And I'm delighted to be here. It's my first time in Austin and at this festival, so I'm really happy to be here.
So I'm Jason Schultz. I'm a fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. For 4.5 years, I was a senior staff attorney there. I now teach at UC Berkeley Law School. And I'm also a copyright lawyer. And a lot of what I focused on at EFF and what I teach is issues in copyright relating to fair use and fan creativity as a way of thinking about free speech, that fans can be incredibly creative with copyrighted works that were originally created by someone else. And one of the things that interests me about this panel, and I think it's worth talking about, is what happens if fan creativity actually kind of exceeds the original creator. Someone makes something and then the fans actually take it to kind of a higher level or a bigger level. And sort of if the purpose of copyright is to generate creativity, where do we draw the lines around that? And so that's a lot of what I'm interested in talking about.
Very good. All right, so kind of just jump right in with that. Speaking of kind of these fan-created works and things like that, where do you guys see the effects of piracy on your projects? I'm sure they kind of range down the thing, and do they help or hurt, and where does that kind of impact culture? Jump in, anyone.
Well, actually, we haven't found much evidence of piracy in the sense of people downloading the film or trading the film on peer-to-peer networks for free, but we have had a lot of licensing issues, people using the film without purchasing the proper licensing. I actually am not that concerned about it. I mean,
I think we're giving your film away, right?
We're not giving.
You were streaming
very briefly
it?
when we first released it. We were right. We were actually on the Sundance Online Festival, and so you could stream it for free for the first. I guess it was about 6 months after the initial festival, but we've been selling it on DVD, and also packaging it as part of a discussion kit. I think there are a couple of issues going on. One is that for us as independent producers, you know, some kinds of piracy actually help us. If you know, as an independent producer, one of the major things you want to do is get the word out about your film, and piracy can do that for you, which I think is something that MDOT was referring to. The other issue, though, is that our basic interest is maintaining some degree of revenue in order to maintain our outreach efforts. And one of the ways we've been able to sort of defend ourselves against, you know, people not buying the film at all is to create these discussion kits. So they create a kind of added value beyond, you know, a downloadable film. We also distribute the film on iTunes, so that also somewhat lessens the risk of piracy, just because at $1.99 for a short film download, it's just as easy as trying to find it on a peer-to-peer network. But one of the things that we found interesting is that you actually only need a very small core fan base in order to maintain yourself as an artist, to sustain yourself and your efforts in doing outreach. That there's some estimate that if you have 1,000 what they call true fans, people who will buy everything you put out, who are willing to put out, let's say, $100 a year on your products, that adds up to about $100,000 a year. And subtracting minimal distribution costs, that's a good living for an artist, for anybody, I would think. Of course, you know, with a film production, film crew, you have greater expenses, so that increases. You need more fans to support a crew rather than a solo artist, but it doesn't increase dramatically. And we found that it's actually very easy to maintain some, you know, reasonable revenue just based on a smaller fan base. And I think that's partly what digital distribution and even piracy has been able to support. There's gone to be a larger middle ground for, you know, independent producers. You don't have to become a superstar, but you don't have to starve either.
Well, I'm going to ramble about a bunch of stuff, but let me just say that let's lay down some guidelines or some rules, right? So let's just say there's two different worlds at work here. So there's the big game, let's just say Warner Brothers and, you know, majors that have big budgets are part of the big game. And then people like me, or probably most of you, we're in this little small sphere. So there's two different sets of rules. So first, I just want to say in my game, in the small sphere, it's like you have a face. If you're out there, hopefully, you know, you're using social networks and YouTube or whatever to show your face to your audience, your fans or whatever. Because I was thinking of something when I was walking here, and it's like, if you're faceless, you can't lose or save face. But if you have a face, you can do so. So it's like people like making connection with your fans and your audience. I mean, if your stuff gets pirated, like, I just think your fear should be that no one wants to watch it anyway. So if anybody wants to watch it in any type, you know, you should be happy that someone wants to see it, right? And if you come out and you're like, oh, don't pirate my stuff, stop it, or, you know, try to stop people, then you look like a jerk. So you lose face because you have a face. But like a big company doesn't have a face, really. And it's like people will steal from corporations, but not from individuals. So they can go out and they punish people because it's part of their business. You know, they have this business model that works, and that's part of the big game, so they can do it. So I think first, that's a guideline we should kind of throw down. I think it's different if you're an individual or someone that's big. But I think the fear that all of us should have if you're in the small sphere is like obscurity. So can I show some of those?
Sure, sure, sure.
So my film, right when I put the DVD on sale.
Which one do you want to show?
The first one, the one that says the NFO file. Yeah. So if you don't know what this is, so this big like movie pirating group in Sweden like released it, right? And this guy sent it to me. And I guess normally you would be like pissed off, like, oh my God, lost sales, right? But so this is like, just think of this as like a new type of movie poster, right? So these are people that like rip your movie and then they write up. It's totally just like they don't care, you know, it says. But this is like maybe like a write up or, you know, publicity or press you can't buy or, you know, buy off or whatever. So with mine, I guess it's pretty good. He said, this is a goodie. Don't take acid. So
it's a good advice.
Yeah. So that's actually a good review because it's mostly like this movie sucks. I hate it. And then if you scroll down to the bottom, you see that they're not totally against buying for stuff. It says buy if you like them. Some are worth it. So this is like a new type of movie poster. So these come with all these like torrented releases, whatever. And you should be flattered if anyone does this for your movie, because there's some guy that's staying up like typing all this stuff in because they think your stuff is worth something. They want to put it out. And then the one that says like release, the one you had up first. No.
Okay.
Yeah, that one. So this is like, now this is something you can't control that's put out there by other people. But this kind of like press is like invaluable, because this is just some other weirdo out there in the world that pirate stuff saying, hey, this is pretty cool, I think you should watch it. And then yeah, you know, you can put up the comment. And then look, George W. Bush commented on it. And he turned the screensaver on. That's the type of power a government has here.
There you go.
But so there's two spheres. So if you're in the small sphere, if anybody wants to watch in any way and put it out, you should be flattered that people are discussing whatever. And it didn't hurt my DVD sales, because I'm just selling the DVD. And you say, why? People will say, if they can just download it, why would they buy your DVD? Well, firstly, hopefully you're using those social networking sites, so you have a face, so people feel bad if you're starving to death, if you're photoshopping ribs onto your pictures so you look like you're skinny and losing weight. You know, that's some shameless stuff you can do. But, you know, if you have that face. But then it just comes up to the filmmaker having to innovate. So like on my DVD, I like paid extra to get a digipack and made it all nice, whatever, did all the design. But I did something like I put 7 soundtracks on my film so you can switch through them. And that's something you can't duplicate by pirating it. So it's like you want people to pirate your stuff, and you just have to do some more work to innovate to give them features they can't get through a download right now. I mean, maybe with Microsoft Silverlight and Blue, you know, whatever, these new technologies, they will. But so I just want to say there's two different spheres. So even though I'm pro piracy, I'm not going to argue with the big game because it's a different game. We don't play by the same rules.
Well, as a representative of the faceless big game, I agree with a lot of what MDOT says. I mean, in terms of the sort of pictures that Warner Brothers makes and most of the major studios make, because of the budgets of those films, we actually need to be able to distribute them not just theatrically, but in all these various windows of distribution, from home video and pay television and iTunes and other forms of digital distribution, all the way through to over-the-air broadcast, in order to generally make an economic return on those films. In fact, for most major films now, theatrical release only accounts for 25% of the revenues, and the other 75% are all earned in the downstream windows of distribution. So for us, you know, it's not enough to make $100,000 on a film that costs, you know, $100 million. And so, you know, MDOT is very right. The sort of the rules of the game are different. That being said, you know, Ben's question was, what about these fan sites, you know, and are they something that help promote your work, or are they detracting from your work? And Jason was saying, well, what about fan sites where they create something that may be, you know, more interesting than the original work? We have taken and Harry Potter is a very, very good example. A very, very liberal attitude towards fan sites. We think that fan sites, people who are on fan sites are obviously fans of the work. They're enthusiasts about the work. They're interested in the work. And so we don't really want to seek to alienate them by, you know, trying to shut them down. So what we do, sometimes we even supply materials for fan sites, for people to use them. Where we tend to draw the line is if somebody starts selling stuff off their fan site. And the way we do that is usually we just contact the fan site operator directly and we say, you know, we've visited your site, we like what you're doing this, you're doing that, but, you know, really, you can't start selling your own t-shirt, Harry Potter t-shirts, because that's sort of getting into, you know, infringement and where have those rights to kind of economically make the revenue from that. And it's shared with J.K. Rowling and all the rest of it. And I would say in like 95% of the times they say, okay, that's fine. We understand. And so we actually build a relationship with the fan sites. Same thing with our subsidiary, DC Comics. There are a tremendous number of fan sites out there. And some of the stuff that people do, I wish I had the clip. There's this one of animated Batman and Superman in a coffee shop, and they're just trying to one-up each other, and it's just hysterical. And in fact, it won some prize in a comic book festival. DC Comics regularly, you know, not only tolerates that, but encourages it, because it keeps interest up on those characters. And in fact, in between movies, like if you've got a franchise like a Batman or a Harry Potter, you know, those fan sites that talk about what's going on in the next movie or who's gonna be the next Superman and all that stuff, they actually help generate continuing interest in the properties that we probably couldn't even do as good a job of generating that sort of interest. So that's the sort of, you know, perspective that we take on them.
Yeah, well, so I don't have any personal material except for a blog, so I don't really have that much investment in the making of the material. But sort of two thoughts that occurred from listening to this. In the publishing industry right now, with books, Tim O'Reilly, who's a publisher of a lot of tech books, said once that obscurity is the biggest threat to the publishing industry, far more than piracy. And so I think, yeah, this reflects some of that thinking as well, and I agree with that depending on how easy it is to forget you, that will influence how much you care about people taking your stuff, because taking it indicates interest. On the flip side, and I mean, I really like, you know, some of the things you've said, Dean, but I have a question. I think that people often, even if they get a nice email from, you know, Warner Brothers, will feel intimidated, right? Or could feel intimidated, especially if it's from a lawyer. And I'm wondering if this is a policy that you all have, is it stated anywhere in sort of a positive way where people can sort of reference it on a website or someplace, or is there any way for people to feel some comfort? Because I think one of the things that EFF and sort of looking at this from, you know, a fan point of view is, you know, is it a question of you just haven't found me yet and you're going to crush me? Or is it a question of, hey, there's a free zone here. And you know, if you tell me where it is and I know where I can play, at least where I know where I'm safe, and then maybe there's a little bit of a danger zone and I can assess whether I want to take that risk or not. And so I'm wondering, you know, how clear is it when you send, I mean, these emails, but also is there a sort of a public way that fans can really get a sense? Because I know that we don't have to talk about this case, but there's a case involving the Harry Potter lexicon.
Right, right.
You know, and I think, which is a sort of attempt to try and put together an encyclopedia of sorts, and there's some disagreement about whether they should be able to commercialize it or not and how much information. And we don't have to get into the details, but I think one of the things that came out of that case was a sense of unclarity, a lack of clarity about where that line is ahead of time. And so if people invest, like I know a lot of fans who invest hundreds of hours, and then, yeah, you don't want to take it down. I mean, if you've really made this your life, not your life's work, but your month's work or whatever.
Right. I mean, Jason, that's a very good point. And in fact, it's very interesting because we've had a lot of discussions internally, not just at Warner Brothers, but at Turner DC and sort of across the various divisions of the company as to should we have and publish guidelines exactly what you're describing, or should we not? And there are all sorts of considerations on that. People in the company, mostly many lawyers, who feel very nervous about the idea of sort of saying, well, if we say you can do it in guidelines, are we somehow waiving any legal rights and things like that? There's also, beyond that, guild considerations that if we say, well, you can do this, you know, are we somehow then giving the fans the rights to reuse stuff, and then we're going to get claims from guilds that say, well, you know, you've authorized that and we're not being paid for it and you're responsible for it. And so there are some tricky guild issues that are also involved in some of that. But there have been a lot of discussions about whether we should do that exactly for the reasons that you're saying, so that, you know, the people who are operating fan sites and contributing to fan sites have sort of a clear sense of what the rules of the road are. And when, by the way, and when usually if we feel that something's crossed the line, they actually don't get a letter from a lawyer. They get a phone call from a non-lawyer, you know, and so it's a pretty, we have a couple of guys who are sort of dedicated to both looking for piracy online and checking out the fan sites, and they, you know, end up calling the webmaster and talking to the people who run the sites, and it's a pretty non-threatening thing. The Lexicon case is a very, very interesting case because that Lexicon was online for a long time, and it was, you know, thought to be just perfectly fine as far as Warner Brothers was concerned and J.K. Rowling was concerned. And then when they wanted to publish it and sort of do it as a hard copy book that was going to be making money, you know, that's where the line was. We did not sue the author, we sued the publisher. So saying, yeah.
Go ahead. We already got some questions. So yeah, if you have questions, let's jump in anytime.
Panelists to distinguish, if you can, between downloading for free piracy and reusing to create a new work, which it seems to me invokes fair use, because the other distinction that is troubling me generally in this discussion, not on this panel, but more generally, is a discussion that says, oh, it's okay to use this stuff to create new material or to comment on it if you're doing it non-commercially. But if you do it commercially, then I want the rights back. And it seems to me that that fair use is fair use, whether you're in a commercial or a non-commercial environment, if you're transforming it, using it for a new purpose. And that's why I want to distinguish it from piracy. And let me just say, I'm Pat Afterhady from the American University. We did a study recently called Recut, Reframe, Recycle, showing that many of the uses that people put copyrighted material in films too in online video are legitimately able to be considered as fair use. And I would like to hear particularly Mr. Schultz comment on the capacity of people to both use material for free and then potentially to monetize their investment.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, so to get into a discussion of fair use for a moment, there are many commercial fair uses. In fact, many of the leading Supreme Court cases and other court cases from appellate courts that have found fair use have been highly commercial fair use. So one of the most famous is that Two Live Crew right. did a parody of Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman and sold it. I mean, absolutely, as a commercial product. And the Supreme Court said that was fine. But in those cases, and absolutely, as you point out, it is about the sort of, not always, but primarily about the transformative nature, doing something creative which furthers the purpose of copyright law. I mean, that's how the courts look at it, right? Which is more creative work, more art, more interesting stuff. And I think that's true. I mean, even in the kind of fair use where like a newspaper might quote from a book in a book review or do some other kind of thing. I mean, newspapers make money. And so I do think this is a struggle, especially online right now, because so many sites can't operate totally for free. And you know, if you especially have huge bandwidth costs, right? It's hard to have, you know, 10,000 or 100,000 views, you know, an hour or a month or whatever, and not pay off your server costs, right? So I think the commercial, non-commercial line is actually getting kind of blurred. So I think, I don't know if you look at that, whether it's like, are they generating just enough money to kind of keep the site going versus actually selling it as a product? But I think that, yeah, I think there is a space, a big space for commercial use from my perspective, especially in the sort of creative or commentary aspect. Which is different than the wholesale verbatim, just copying the original and just redistributing it.
Right. I'm really glad you brought up the point because, in fact, I think, and let's put aside the verbatim copying, which I think, you know, maybe most people in this room, if not everybody, could agree, whether you as the creator are encouraging that, like if MDOT's saying, I'm fine with people making verbatim copies of my work, then you're, in fact, it's really not infringement because you're giving permission. I mean, the whole thing is the rights owner, and he's the owner of the work that he's created, has the ability to say, you know, I want this to be copied and redistributed, or I don't. I want it to be paid for it, or I don't necessarily have to have it be paid for every time. But in what you're talking about, the transformative works, you're absolutely right. If something is a fair use and qualifies as a fair use under the law, as Jason said in the Two Live Crew case, they were selling this record. It doesn't matter if it's a commercial use. And in fact, one of the fair use factors is really not so much is the use commercial or non-commercial, but is the work a substitute for the original work, and does it have, you know, a negative impact on the market for the original work? And usually parodies say, no, if somebody's buying the parody, it's not a substitute for an original work. It's because it's commenting on the original work. Where it gets hazy, and maybe this will be a good time to show some of the clips and why we tend to talk about, from our vantage point, commercial uses versus non-commercial uses, is fair use is a complicated test. It's a test that involves four factors. Yeah. It's very difficult to predict. You know what? I was going to show the first one.
Show the other ring one.
Yeah. And so it's that's why we're willing to say you get a wider berth if it's non-commercial.
Ring full. Start at the beginning of that.
Sure. Here's a clip from Lord of the Rings that someone cut themselves into.
Strangers from distant
as a new character
lands,
in the scene.
Of old, you've been summoned here to answer the threat of Mordor. Bring forth the ring, Frodo.
It is the ring. Are you all seeing this? Legolas! Well, somebody needs to take it.
Have a bad, Legolas. You cannot wield it. The One Ring answers to Sauron alone.
And you have only one choice.
What is the choice?
The ring must be destroyed.
And what are we waiting for?
Make him leave!
The ring was made in the fires of Mount Doom. It must be taken deep into Mordor and cast back into the fiery chasm from whence it came. One of you must do this.
Oh, I get it. One of us has to go, but clearly, you know, you could have just asked me for my dragon. We're not going to be able to do this without my dragon. Gandalf, you're the one that summoned him from the Netherworld. You know, just give me the ring, I'll plop on top of him, I'll just fly off. I'll be back in a matter of seconds, I'll be here for tea by the end of the night. Look, as soon as I get there at Mount Doom, I'll just walk off the dragon with the ring.
Let's not simply walk into Mordor.
Well, fine, I don't have to walk. I can just hover above, my dragon does hover, and then I'll just throw the ring into the lava.
Its black gates are guarded by more than just orcs.
Right, my dragon can take out orcs and Uruk-hai. I mean, really anything evil.
Anyway.
Boom, dead.
So
it's a great clip.
There's an example that Lord of the Rings, our sister company New Line, put out that movie. Hopefully, most of you have seen it. And this is on YouTube, and it's called "The Lord of the Rings Was Too Long." I think if you were to do a fair use analysis under the law of that, I think there would be a very, very good argument that it would qualify as parody. It's commenting on the original. It's poking fun at the original. It's also very, very well done in my view. You know, I think a lot of when cases get to courts, you know, if something makes the judge laugh, they've won. You know, I mean, it's just kind of that's you know, if the judge finds it amusing, then it's parody and it's fair use and they've won. So if somebody went to commercialize that, you know, who knows? Would New Line go after them? Would we go after them? I would say probably not. It's not a substitute, you know, for the original Lord of the Rings. One could argue there's too much taking. They didn't need to take that much to you know, be able to quote unquote conjure up the original, which is one of the standards in this. But, you know, clearly this is a transformative work. There was a lot of creativity that went into this, the way they spliced it and put her in there and, you know, made it really seem like she was inserted in there as a character and kind of making fun of, you know, why don't you just get on the dragon, drop the ring and be done with it? And you could have given, you know, could have done this in one movie, you know, instead of three. Let's look at the second clip, Ben. And it'll be very interesting. I don't know if you have the title, Ben, but this one says Harry Potter. You know, very, very kind of cute and fun syncing of, you know, various clips of the Harry Potter film to that song. I would say that probably would not qualify as a fair use. I mean, there is some transformative as they're stringing the clips together, but it's really not commenting much on the original, I would imagine. Certainly, you know, since that's a song where the song isn't modified, I think, you know, the composer or the owner of the copyright in the musical recording could say, look, just putting, you know, some video next to my entire song doesn't transform it. Okay, so I would say very unlikely that would qualify as a fair use. What's Warner Brothers' attitude towards it? You know, what's our company's attitude towards it? That's up on YouTube. We wouldn't ask that be taken down on YouTube. It's not, you know, impacting the sales of our Harry Potter videos, and it's, you know, something more akin to, you know, a fan transformation sort of thing, or you know, fan use. And in fact, even on YouTube, like Smallville's very, very popular. When somebody loads up the entire episode, or if they load up, you know, the episode, television episode, just cut into three or four chunks, we ask that it be removed. If somebody says, here are my favorite shots and scenes of Tom Weller, we don't. You know, we regard it as sort of fan promotion and fan interest. So, you know, it, this is sort of a long-winded way of circling back to, I don't know if she's still in the room, but the lady from the Library Association who asked the question, if the person who put up the second video started selling it, they'd probably be on very, very thin ice, because they're just doing it as a non-commercial use. We're more willing to tolerate it. On the first one, you know, if that creator decided she wanted to sell it, you know, she may be on stronger ground, because it's probably has a stronger argument for qualifying as a legal fair use. But because fair use is frankly such an unpredictable legal doctrine, and it's such an all or nothing legal doctrine, it's like, if you're the creator, the fair user, and you win, you can do anything you want with the work. You can sell it, you can, you know, commercially exploit it, and the copyright owner can't stop you. If you lose, usually the relief, the remedy is injunction, which is that you have to stop distributing it altogether. And so that's why we sort of rest on this ground of saying basically non-commercial uses, where we give the creativity, the transformation, the fan use, greater breathing space.
All right, so I can get another question.
Hey, so what about doing away with copyright, or like thinking about that altogether? Because I think that, I don't know, like analyzing these clips, and there is some creativity going on no matter what, and it could be important that we attribute artworks back to authors, But it could also not be important. I think there's been a lot of thinking about this, like in the later part of this century and recently, where it's not that important who made it. And in a way, every reading of a text is a new experience that's as much the reader's creation as it is the author's. Or not as much, but it's a that is a dialogue, you know, and that's not just a one-way kind of send-receive sort of relationship. So I wonder, like, sort of on the M dot tip and then going even more extreme maybe, what about not having copyright whatsoever? It's up to people to kind of discover who made something, kind of almost like an anonymous, like at a radical extreme, anonymous generation of stuff. So people don't know. And I mean, I'm one to talk about this in a way because I'm like in my movies, so you can tell who made it if you meet me and whatever. And part of the reason I did that actually was sort of in order to be attributable to my artwork, because I do think that it is totally disconnected from you in a way. So anyway, I wonder how you guys would think about that as sort of a radical extreme. No copyright whatsoever, and not worrying about that and just making stuff and realizing that if people are into it, whatever, they'll come back and they'll find you and they'll give you money.
Okay, well, I'll just say from the small sphere where I'm at, I guess copyright doesn't really matter. It's just like $55 I pay to like register something, but I'll probably never use it. So it doesn't really matter in my sphere, I guess, copyright, because I haven't had to defend it yet, and I don't think I would really have the money to do it anyway. So if it didn't exist, it wouldn't really matter to me. And I just wanted to say something about the obscurity. Like, you don't have a fear of obscurity if you have a P&A budget. So if you're in the big sphere, you don't have to be afraid of being obscure, so like some of this stuff doesn't apply. But if you don't have a P&A budget, like if you're an individual, then, you know.
So do we think, does a piracy scale where that line becomes between promotion and piracy? Does that scale?
Yeah, because if you don't have a P&A budget, the piracy is your promotion. I just want to say, like, if you are someone like, you know, very small production or whatever, don't look at piracy as a lost sale. Look at it like you just gained a fan. And I mean, the whole thing, the whole shift in the media from, you know, the big system to smaller ones is all about, you know, owning your audience and having your own audience. So just look at it like that, like you're possibly gaining a new audience member, a fan, rather than losing a sale, and it's a potential sale in the future.
So but imagine if you did that without people knowing fans. Who you were. Like, that's the extreme, okay. I feel like, is anonymous. So people don't know this is all M. Strange. Like, would you still want to do it? Would it still be worthwhile? Would it still be exciting?
Yeah, because like I said, if you're putting yourself out there, people know someone down the line is going to come back and say, who made this? And if you're out there and you're available, they'll find you. And people are concerned. Like, people just send me money to my PayPal just because. Or they're like, are you okay? You look hungry, you know? So if you have done your job and created that connection with your audience, that, you know, there are people out there that, and I think, I mean, you can say it's altruistic or whatever, but I think eventually, because you'll be able to pirate anything at all times from anywhere, it's going to be really hard to monetize anything digital. And I think, I don't know, if you've done your work, it's going to come back to a point. I mean, people might say I'm crazy, but my name's M. Strange, so whatever. But to a point where there'll be patrons of the arts, you know, where people will see, I appreciate the value of this work. And the more commercial it is and the kind of less magic it has in it as art, it's going to be harder to do that. You know, because it is something that's very commercial. But if it's something that's more creative or that you put more of yourself into that allows you to express your individuality, which you should be doing anyway, it can be something that people can just appreciate. You know, like classical composers, I'm not doing classical music, but there are people who are like patrons of Bach and they just gave him money because his music just like enhanced their lives. And I think maybe we'll come back to that. Well, people will just support their artist in different ways. So copyright and, you know, anything else wouldn't matter. It's like you put it out, let them re-edit it. And if someone re-edited my film and made it better than the way I did it, I'd ask for the autograph and quit. But
so I think there's a couple different things. If they're just creating art to create art and it's just out there anonymous, it's great. If they don't want to be paid or recognized for that, and then there's the other side of releasing it, but you do want to be recognized and you want to bring fans back that may find your work.
And it could happen, you know, where there'll be some type of sophisticated fingerprinting. So you could just have a digital file that you are the creator of and you put it out there, and it doesn't matter who's playing it or who's manipulating it. You know, there'll be a way to like pay you back for it. I mean, I don't know where that is now, but I can see that kind of happening in the future. So you could be anonymous and it, you know, copyrights could not matter.
So is there anything artists should do to pirate their films to make sure they are recognized for that, to bring the fans in that find them their content places so they can come back to you?
Well, I mean, I didn't really do anything special, but put my DVD out and people got it. And I mean, just create an interesting, unique product. And I don't know, put yourself out there. That's all I did. I just go on YouTube and point at my own face. I'm like, yeah, here I am. And yeah, you could, but it's kind of like you could upload it to torrent networks, whatever, but it kind of works against you because like when I showed you the NFO file, you want one of these like pirate, like admin dudes putting a stamp of approval on your movie, you know, and putting it out there because then all the other geeks that are just surfing torrent sites that are super jaded, like, oh yeah, I can watch that. You know, they watch everything and they hate it. So kind of is like a new gatekeeper. So make friends with hackers.
It's a new reviewer.
And lawyers. So, yeah, if you wanted to make the whole torrential thing official, yeah, you would send DVDs to the admins of all these torrent sites and all in make friends in the scene. That's what it's called. So I kind of actually I did make friends. Like I should tell the true story. One of the admins from that Swedish site, I had my YouTube fans subtitle my movie in 17 languages. And the guy who did Swedish is friends with that pirating group. So he gave it to him and then he gave me the stamp of approval and put it out. And then I don't know how many like hundreds of thousands of downloads it got. And yeah, so.
One thing I noticed about them is that they don't actually want to do that until the DVD is available in some.
Yeah, they won't pirate it until they're able to steal it. Like if it's not available through retail, they don't want it.
All right, we got another question.
Hi. As a writer, I would just want to say I'm really happy with the copyright laws right now. But I'm a student filmmaker and going back and getting a certificate in screenwriting, and I'm about to embark on a film. And when any of the professors review my screenplay in the beginning, I had, you know, movie clips playing in the background and certain songs I wanted to use. And of course, they all cross those out and say, forget it, you can't afford the rights to those. And I'm wondering, can't we come to some tiered system where, you know, I'm not going to make any money on my first movie, but some of these things are very important for the plot and the symbolism in the movie. I mean, if you know I'm not going to make a $12 million blockbuster, can't we have some kind of tiered system where I can apply to get the copyright to use those little clips in my movie and not have to pay you $300,000 for the rights?
That's I'm really glad you asked that question. It could almost be a setup because at Warner Brothers, we're actually, I'm very proud to say, we're really pretty good about that stuff in terms of when we get requests from film schools or from film students who are doing stuff, as long as they're not asking to use like a 20-minute clip of something, but if they're asking to use, you know, a 30-second or a minute clip of stuff like that, we generally, what we do, we don't give a license, again, because of, you know, sort of guild issues, particularly if it's going into, you know, another film, but we just issue a no objection letter where we say, you know, if you want to use it, we won't object. And then we'll always say, you know, that doesn't mean we've given you clearance as far as the actors and the writers and the composers. And here's the Screen Actors Guild, you know, number and contact them. And, you know, most people usually don't. They figure if they've gotten it from the copyright holder, they're okay. But we do that. I mean, you know, it's very expensive in terms of when, you know, the studios are licensing stuff from other studios, or when you have a major film and you're putting in even 30 seconds from a song, it can cost, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40,000. I mean, it can be very, very expensive. But then, you know, on the other hand, it's being used for a very, very commercial use. We tend to, in our clip licensing department, you know, look at what the use is. And if it's a documentary use, if it's a film school use, if it's a film student use, license accordingly. I cannot say that all the film major studios do that, nor do necessarily all the record companies do that. But, you know, I think I'm proud of the fact that we actually do that at Warner Brothers. And then I would say also, you know, if you're making a student film and if you're not planning to really commercialize it, the chances of you getting, I mean, sued by a copyright holder, I think, are pretty slim. You know, and so at a certain point, there are sometimes uses like, you know, when I started with the company, and you know, I was in the the licensing and merchandising department. And, you know, we get like letters from high schools wanting to use Bugs Bunny as their mascot, and we would just like go, "Oh, please don't write to us. Just use it. You know, just don't ask. You know, because it's not a commercial use, but yet as a trademark holder, you know, you have to sort of exercise quality control. So if they asked us if we wanted to let them use it, we'd have to have them resubmit the pages to make sure the character was used properly. And so there is a certain point of, if you're doing something like in a student project like that, maybe it's going to go on the festival circuit, but you're not really seeking commercial distribution of it. I would say, you know, seek the licenses, but if there's something you really need and want in your film and it's a short use and you're not going to get the permission, I think your chances of getting sued are really, really minimal. And so I just wouldn't let it, you know, stop you from doing something that you feel is important to your film. And that's just know later on, you know, if you do become even an independent director with some success, you do need to go the licensing route. I did want to also just sort of respond to what this gentleman said about the copyright law. I mean, definitely there, you know, is in the new digital space where people can create things and promote themselves and reach a worldwide audience, you know, on YouTube and on social networking spaces. It's a different world, and it's a great world for that. And if people want to do that without sort of asserting rights, they should be free to do so. But in copyright is really sort of a form of property rights where it's based upon the notion that people who create things, you know, are entitled to the fruits of their labor. And, you know, in this country, I mean, our copyright industries, you know, music, film, publishing, software, it's a huge driver of our economy. And if there was just no copyright law whatsoever, one wonders, you know, what it would do to employment, you know, in these sectors. I mean, you know, forget the directors and actors. What about the set builders and the electricians? And so, you know, it's just, if you're going to have, particularly like in the audiovisual sector, you know, major films with major budgets, with major special effects and all the richness, you know, some people would say crassness, but whatever that audience expect, it takes money and an investment, and you need the law to sort of back up that investment to be able to exercise what are really property rights to enable an economic return. So,
yeah, if I could just add to that, I mean, I'm a copyright lawyer, so I'd be a little sad if there was no copyright law in a sense. But
we'd be out of business, Jason.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I mean, from a broader perspective, the purpose, the sort of original purpose of copyright law, going back into even before this country was founded, coming from England, was to enable the industries and the people who wanted to make creative works, right? And so if we get to a point at some point where we can create everything we want and we don't need this law, then I think you have a legitimate question, right? But I think we're in a time of flux and transition now where I don't know that that's the case. But I do think that we may need to play by some different rules. So I do think questioning the rules you play by in copyright law is as valid as questioning whether we need it or not. And I'll say that, you know, it depends what time frame you want to look at, but 20, 30 years ago, there weren't as many individual creators who could just make something and put it up on YouTube, right? It was, you had to be more of a big player, or if you were a small player, you had to find a big player who would front you, right? Who would get your stuff out there. And that's changing now, which means maybe some of these rules need to change. And that's why looking at things like fair use and wondering how expansive or contracted it should be are important, but also kind of more open liberal licensing. So many of you might not know about things such as Creative Commons licenses or any sort of more open licenses that say some rights are reserved, not all rights are reserved to my copyright. So maybe I'll allow people to do non-commercial uses if they attribute it back to me, things like that. There are more options for kind of having a less restrictive approach to copyright. And I think that's kind of where we're at right now, is you can decide, I want to reserve everything, I want to reserve some things, maybe I don't want to reserve anything. But I think the metric should be about how much creativity we're seeing in each sector. And if we're seeing an underproduction of creativity, then maybe the law is too restrictive. If we're seeing enough creativity, then maybe we don't have to worry about the law, and the law is fine where it is. And I think, you know, what we're talking about here are different industries that are sort of battling with those metrics. One thing I want to point out quickly, though, about, and I'm glad Pat's back too, is that when you look at issues like clearances, there's a great best practices document about what things can qualify for. And you should talk to Pat afterwards if you're interested, about what things can qualify or have generally been agreed upon to be fair use in documentary films and things like that. And that's actually led to, I believe, one insurance company to offer E&O insurance. Now, four?
All the insurance companies in America that insure documentary films now insure for fair use.
Right. So if so, there are ways in terms of like you can ask permission for sure, but there are also ways in which you can try and qualify so that the insurance company will cover you in case you do get sued later.
All right. So we've got about 10 minutes left. So I want to make sure we get a couple more questions in.
Okay.
I just want to say something real quick.
Yeah. I just wanted to respond to your question. Also, the tribe was made up of about 60% archival footage, and the majority of the rest of the footage featured the Barbie doll. So we were very concerned about copyright infringement. But we found actually, well, first of all, the issues with Mattel, we made sure that we were covered and made sure that it was a parody. We actually had, I think, 5 Mattel lawyers show up at the premiere and then never heard anything about it. So that turned out to be fine. But we found with the archival stuff that actually there is sort of a scale that, when we spoke to the copyright owners or their representatives and explained to them what the film was about, how we intended to use it, most people were very flexible about licensing. There was one case in which we wanted to use a small clip of the New York Dolls, and it was outrageously expensive. But that was actually an independent, producer who had shot the stuff in the early 70s and, makes his living from the photographs and footage that he got. But that was the only case that I can think of where we really could not afford or not negotiate some sort of licensing arrangement that worked for both parties.
All right, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking back prior to piracy even being an issue, prior to the internet, prior to DVDs, early 1970s, a young man did a black and white animation called Bambi Meets Godzilla. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but it cute classic. Little deer chomping grass, right. All of a sudden Godzilla's foot comes down, right. Dead deer, end of film. It became so hilarious and so passed around in the underground that the way that it was handled, not with lawyers and copyrights, but they just bought it from the young man, used it as a lead-in in their very next Godzilla film. Another thought is the idea about the gentleman that came up, no copyrights whatsoever. It seems to me, aren't they kind of doing something like that with the TV series Lost? I mean, they've been using their fan base, and they've actually created some, in my perception, fake fan sites on the web to promote the TV series and get more buzz. I mean, this might be a different kind of a backdoor way to looking at MDOT's embrace the pain type approach to working with hackers or whatever, but still. Isn't there a better way, or what do you think about some of these alternative ways that might have been established in the past?
Thanks. Well, I mean, I do remember Bambi Meets Godzilla. I thought it was hysterical. And I think probably good chance that, that would pass the fair use test. I mean, as being transformative, as sort of being a parody on sort of Disney's movies and all the rest of it. And so once again, if something qualifies as a fair use, it's freely commercially exploitable and all the rest of it. In terms of people using fan sites to promote their things or, like, what was it? Lost Girl, 15-year-old Lost Girl or whatever.
Lonely Girl.
Lonely Girl 15, which really turned out not to be, it was all kind of, I can't remember which major company was behind it, but it's,
it was an independent production, yeah.
They wanted to break in.
Right, but
the lines are definitely blurring between
herself.
What production companies are making and what their fans are creating and how they're integrating both the feedback loop between both is now creating what I believe to be better product. So the fans are more engaged, the companies in direct contact with the fans.
I think those lines are blurred, but there's nothing wrong.
Well, here's an idea. You could cam your own movie. So does everybody know what camming is? That's when a movie first comes out and someone goes with the video camera and records it like with a shake. So you could play it on your TV and cam it and then put it out and people are like, oh, I want to watch it because cams are very popular. So
just real quick on the Lost thing, actually, one funny thing is so the Hanzo Corporation, which was the fake corporation or foundation in Lost, they did place some fake websites up and run some fake ads. I had a friend who created a T-shirt that said Hanzo Foundation on it and received a cease and desist letter from ABC. So there are some different views about how far they're willing to let that go.
All right, go ahead.
Hi, I'm here from the interactive part of South by Southwest, which is a technology conference. And I was wondering what your positions were about large companies, large corporations lobbying to inject copyright management technology into requiring manufacturers to put that into their televisions or DVD players, and how you think that affects the technology realm or any positions on that.
I think it's pointless, actually. I think any technology that comes up, you know, that's supposed to protect copyright can easily be replicated and undone. So it seems like a very, I mean, in my point of view, a very sort of temporary band-aid to, you know, if you're trying to protect copyright. Yeah, I mean, it's that over, you know, over centuries, that's been proven over and over again, that the technologies are easy, that are meant to protect whatever entity end up being replicated and used exactly for the opposite.
Well, I'll add two things. That one, I think any kind of mandatory requirement on technology companies to put this technology in is hugely burdensome and really is going to just shut down a huge part of the technology sector. Second, we've been talking about fair use, and you know, we show these two clips and we all have our subjective judgments. And like Dean says, they make judgment calls. And quite honestly, I'm a huge fan of technology, but I think judgment calls as to what is creative is something that computers aren't there yet and won't be for a long time. I really like the fact that someone like Dean here is making the decision and actually making a judgment call, and I'd like to keep it that way. And this, it's not only about DRM or these kind of restrictive technologies, but also a lot of the filtering technologies that are being proposed. It raises serious questions because, yeah, I mean, it may be that, you know, in the end you have no objection, but if the filter catches it and doesn't allow it to go up on YouTube in the first place, then no one ever sees it. So I think we have to be very careful about these filtering technologies for the same reasons.
Okay. And I agree. And the focus of my question was perhaps the lobbying aspect, the political aspect of the big sphere being able to influence literally law and changing how copyright law is, where the little sphere does not.
Yeah, as a representative of the big sphere, you know, I have a different view of DRM. I mean, I'm somewhat sober, having, you know, been working on them for the last 15 years. I mean, it's a lot of what I do. There's no question there's that any DRM technology, digital rights management technology, whether it's encryption or watermarking or fingerprinting or filtering, there's no question that it can be defeated. The reason why we use it is it's basically what has been sort of a lingo in the industry is to sort of keep honest people honest and hassle those who aren't. So it's really meant almost as kind of like guidelines and guideposts rather than, you know, something that's meant to be indestructible. So that's the first thing. Like with the encryption that's on DVDs, I mean, it's been hacked for a long time. There's DCSS. You can get it all over the internet. But still, if you put a DVD into a DVD-ROM drive in your personal computer and you drag and drop the file, and then you go back and try and play the file, it doesn't play back, and you just get encrypted garbage. And so it just is sort of to give the consumer a guideline that says, you know, really under normal circumstances, you're not supposed to be copying this DVD. Can somebody download DCSS and decrypt the DVD and then make a copy of it and post it to the internet? Of course they can. But the notion behind the digital rights management technology is to sort of establish some guidelines and guideposts. And as far as technology mandates, which I think was one of your questions, and, you know, I think there was this goes back really back to 1994 when we were first launching the DVD. There was going to be something akin to the Audio Home Recording Act called the Video Digital Rights Recording Act or something like that, where there was going to be a technology mandate to recognize basically a data flag in DVDs. And we had been working with the consumer electronics companies to put together this whole legislative structure, and then, you know, kind of had it all worked out. And then we're talking to the computer companies, and we're quickly sort of, you know, said there is no way we're going to be doing mandatory screening of all the data that comes in to our PCs. It's, you know, really burdensome. And that's where the three industries sat down, and it actually delayed the launch of DVD by about a year and a half, and worked out the system that said, hey, you know, if it's encrypted at the source, then as far as we're concerned with our PCs, you know, it's encrypted in, it's encrypted out. If we want to decrypt it and take a license to decrypt it, then we're willing to follow certain rules. And so that's now really more of the basis on which sort of DRM systems are being built, so that it's voluntary as opposed to legally mandated. And then I just wanted to say one last thing about what Jason mentioned about filters.
Make it very quick.
And that is that I just think he's absolutely right. We've got to be very careful with the filtering technology that I think Fred says that we don't catch the dolphins as we try to, screen out the tuna. So,
all right, we're running right up to the end. So real quick.
Copyright that I run into is that people show up to live shows, and because they own a video camera, they think they have the right to copy it. And it's a big issue. Do you own it because you can copy it?
No. I mean, a simple answer. You don't. Making a copy is not, you know, the people who give a live performance, they have the right in the performance, and you are not allowed under the law to tape it without authorization.
Although that also depends on the producer. I found an event called the Disposable Film Festival, and we encourage people to come to our events, document them, and post them, do whatever they want with them.
That's with permission.
That is with permission.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I had an idea for copyright I wanted to throw out there. What if instead of copywriting it, you essentially sort of claim it as a creation that you've made and also post to it your kind of payee information should people be monetizing it? And that could exist if people were, you know, distributing it. They want to put it out there, maybe onto their airplanes, or someone wants to put it out to their cell phones. They just kind of know what the deal is, or maybe a new platform comes up in some other country with, you know, different pricing structures, and they could just see that license there, see who the payee is, and go from there. And what if that could also be honored in the reusing of other people's media? Because maybe you're a filmmaker that literally just posts, like, you know, your raw footage. You go out there, you get interviews about topics you're interested in. You're kind of like a journalist. You just kind of document things, and that could be used in documentaries. And maybe that actually can be your profession in your revenue stream. And then maybe you're a filmmaker, or maybe even large studios make things, or even bands make things that get reused in other people's work. But what if we could be in a frictionless environment with no lawyers? I mean, sorry to say, because I know that it's a big business.
I'd be happy to get out of the way of that one.
I mean, it accounts for such a huge amount of the industry, the money made by lawyers sitting around making individual contracts. But what if we could make more universal contracts, kind of in the vein of Creative Commons, that just sort of sorted this stuff out? Because we are in the information age, and this is an information problem. So we should be able to solve it with digital technologies, I think.
No, I think a lot of people are looking at that stuff. I mean, certainly in the print publishing world, there's the CCC, the Copyright Clearance Center, where companies particularly, you know, can just take a license, and then they can, you know, take all sorts of clips from all sorts of different publications. There's definitely, I think, a movement afoot to try and do that kind of more frictionless transactions. And that's really kind of the whole idea behind super distribution, where, you know, people send things to other people and say, here, you know, this is a great music video, I really liked it. And you can, like, look at, you know, maybe 30 seconds of it. And then if you want to buy it, you just click and, you know, you make your payment and that's it. You know, I mean, that's I think, a sort of
business model. You could put on your Warner Brothers films these licenses that allowed people to reuse this stuff and actually see some money coming through afterwards. You know what I mean? Like, if you could create an ownership document that essentially said, these people own this amount of it, these people own this amount of it. Because in a way, that's what you do when you get all the bands on board for your film that you're making. You get all the actors. Maybe there's deferred pay. Because people can kind of become shareholders now in the way that a lot of independent films are structured. Because people don't put the money up front. So then afterwards, as a project makes money, it just kind of divvies out to its contributors, even if that's Warner Brothers, or if it's some guy who shot in his bedroom something that ended up getting used in a movie.
So we're right at the end. Thank you for that, though. But if you guys want to come up and chat with these guys, we ran over a little bit. But thank you guys all for coming. I hope you learned something.